Thank you for staying in tune and in touch, and for your ongoing support of this radio station. You are listening to KHSU, and it is once again time for Art Waves. I'm Wendy Butler. Later in the program, a visit with puppet creator, puppetry teacher, and performer Sean Powers. It's time for the 6th annual Puppet Slam on November 3rd at the Sanctuary in Arcata. First on Art Waves today, College of the Redwoods 2018-19 Book of the Year is Brando Skyhorses, The Madonnas of Echo Park. The novel is a series of interconnected stories set in this area of Los Angeles, where the author was born and raised. He will be at CR's Performing Arts Theater on the Eureka Main Campus to give a reading from his work, answer questions, and sign books on Friday, November 9th at 7 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. Brando Skyhorse joined me by phone from his residence in Bloomington, Indiana, where he also teaches. We start with 80s new wave music. There's a good reason. A character in the book, Aurora, loves Morrissey. You know, letting you know, okay, and I couldn't believe this. I love Morrissey. I love the Smiths. I also love...
Oh, okay. A fellow traveler.
I get... Oh, my. And I love Depeche Mode. I mean, I'm still purchasing Depeche Mode. A couple of years ago, they came out with a new album.
They did. I know. I'm probably one of the eight people. You as well. One of the only eight people who are buying them on CD because, you know, it's nostalgia, but it's also like, wow, like it's that connection to like when I was younger and felt like, you know, this is speaking to just to me and nobody else. So
well, and I totally believed that, and I still believe it. And Depeche Mode remains as angry as ever, and I love it. But yeah, I know that Aurora loves Morrissey, so you wrote about that in the Madonna's book. And so I'm curious, for you, what type of role, or if you could expand on what type of role music has or does play in your own personal life.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's essential. I think I mentioned, you know, when we started talking that, you know, I have a little tinnitus. I'm a little deaf in one ear. I'm starting to realize that in my, you know, my mid-40s. And, you know, there's a direct causal link between my music and my headphones and going to a lot of concerts in the 90s and not wearing proper ear protection. Mm. So, like, obviously, that's that kind of physical, tangible connection to music. But, yeah, I mean, it was omnipresent growing up. And I think that especially growing up in a place like Echo Park, I was looking for community. I was looking for that sense of connection. And in my high school, there was a student that I met in 10th grade who was very much into that kind of music, alternative music. Mm-hmm. And not only was it that sense of like, oh, wow, like here's some cool music, here's some cool tunes. And, you know, like it just felt like it was speaking again to me directly. But it also gave me that sense of like, oh, well, if you like this music, you can be our friends. You can get access to this community, right? There is that sense of, you know, we were the cool kids. We knew this secret. Because, again, this, you know, pre-YouTube and everything was like, for music like that, you had to dig a little deep to get it. And now it's like, you can walk into a shoe store and be hearing Depeche Mode and Morrissey, and you know what I mean? So it, for me, it represents that sense of community. It represents a very specific time and place. And I think when I'm trying to write anything, fiction, nonfiction, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to recreate as best I can, like a mood, a feeling, a time, and a place. And yeah, music is an integral part of not only the creation of said work, but, you know, sometimes it seeps into the work as well. And I feel like in Madonna's, music is everywhere for important reasons, you know, because I think it's informing the characters' lives as well, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you commented also in the Q&A that you embrace both your Mexican and Native American cultures now.
I want to
please expand on that if you could.
So to be 100% clear, when I say Native American culture, I mean specifically the haphazard piecemeal culture that my mom attempted to give me when I legitimately believed that I was an American Indian, and when she told me she was legitimately American Indian. So as far as I know, because I haven't done a DNA research or anything, like, I'm Mexican-American, period. I have an American Indian last name.
Mm-hmm.
So part of that heritage is, in this sense, the history and the books and, you know, the sort of the cultural lessons that my mom attempted to give me, you know, rightly or wrongly, you know, like, and that's a whole separate discussion. But I think I kind of grew up in this gray zone where once I realized, oh, I'm actually Mexican-American, and what does that mean exactly?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was something that we didn't really talk about at home, because I think my mother was still in very severe denial about us being Mexican-American. She still considered herself an American Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And so after she passed in, I think I was 23, 24, sometime around then, you know, I took it upon myself to try to figure out what does that mean for me. And that meant very, you know, specific things. It meant being somebody who works in publishing and now teaches. It meant reading a lot of books. It meant reading, like, Mexican-American literature, Mexican-American novels, educating myself about things that perhaps I wasn't quite in the right space to be receptive to back when I was in my 20s, because, you know, I had my mom saying this on one end, and I had, like, my own sort of thoughts and feelings, you know, feeling this way on the other end. And so that led me to the concept of passing, ethnic and racial passing, you know, the idea that someone is attempting to obtain a place that is reserved for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that my mother's attempts to pass me as an American Indian were inspired in part by what she felt, the prejudice that I think she thought I would get or receive as a Mexican American. And I think at the time, that seemed pretty absurd. Now, in 2018, doesn't seem so absurd. So I think kind of understanding where I am on that line and acknowledging that while I am not an American Indian, I do not have tribal ancestry, but that I was raised as such, I can't undo that. That's a part of who I am. That's a part of my story. It would be weird to not acknowledge that. But being a Mexican-American is also a part of my story. And I think that, again, for better or for worse, that upbringing that my mom gave me and being in academia has allowed me to understand how to be conscious of both upbringings, or lack thereof, and both identities. And I try my best to reconcile those. Some days I do better than others. Some days I don't. But I try to reconcile them as best I can.
Brando Skyhorse, author, whose 2010 novel, The Madonnas of Echo Park, among its honors, garnered the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. The novel is also College of the Redwoods, 2018-19 Book of the Year, and Brando Skyhorse will be at CR to give a reading from his work on Friday, November 9th at 7 p.m., at the Performing Arts Theater on the Eureka Main Campus. You're listening to Art Waves. I'm Wendy Butler. And I read about Chavez Ravine and its history.
Fascinating, right? It's fascinating.
That community was, you know, quote, replaced by outsiders, mm-hmm. basically. But then I'm thinking about different characters in your Madonna's book. To what degree does your book explore the notion of how important the physical place is to the psychology of a person? And the reason I'm asking that is I'm thinking about Aurora walking through the streets that are markedly different. And also, I believe the case for Freddie, when Freddie returned, you know, quote, home.
I mean, that's a really excellent question. I mean, thinking about Chavez Ravine, it's like, the eyes of the sports world are at Chavez Ravine tonight. game four of the, you know, I think the game ended. I don't know. It was like 9 hours last I checked or some ridiculous amount, right?
It was the longest game in history, yeah.
In the World Series, yeah. I mean, it made Chapman's Ravine, right? So I think there's that sense of community and history and the storytellers who are connected. Because, again, that story, Chavez Ravine, you know, I went to elementary school in that area. We were probably the closest or one of the closest elementary schools to Chavez Ravine. I never heard that story growing up. I heard that story from my grandmother, you know, who was basically kind of like this sort of neighborhood historian. And I think that sense of connection to place for, you know, my family and also the characters is supremely important. It's called the Madonnas of Echo Park for a reason. I wanted the title, I wanted the neighborhood in the title for that specific reason, not just because of the idea of like, oh, the echoes between characters, the echoes across generations, but the idea that this sense of place was, it served different roles at different times in these people's lives. It could protect them, it could shield them, it could make them invisible, it could track them, depending on where they were in their lives and the decisions that they were making. And so I often tell people that, you know, the character, there are characters that drift in and out of each narrative, but the most important character in the book is Echo Park itself. Mm. And that was very conscious. It was very consciously done. It was very much done by design, because I think I wanted to capture the essence of what that neighborhood meant to me, because that was how I think I felt almost more comfortable in my own identity as a resident of Echo Park than as a Mexican-American or somebody whose mom had passed him off as an American Indian, because, well, why wouldn't I? That's so much clearer. That's so much more concrete.
I'm also thinking about Efren Mendoza.
Efren, sure, yeah. The bus driver,
Who he seemed to reject his own Mexican identity, but then he's united by circumstance with, I believe it's Freddie who gets on the bus,
that's right.
And they drive and they drive together, but it's unknown where they're going. And I'm wondering, I'm wondering if this is somehow finding resolution in identity, like exploring identity in this.
I think that's a wonderful way to visualize it. It's a wonderful way to think about, you know, where their journey is. Because if you wanted to go, you know, past that, like, boy, that first 20 minutes is going to be really awkward, isn't it? Like, just riding around in this bus, you know? Like, so I like the idea of them basically, like, one chapter of both their lives is closed. Mm-hmm. And now another chapter for both of them has to begin. And I think, again, as a fiction writer, it's fun to speculate, it's fun to imagine, but for me, the scope of that story, the fact that they were on the road is enough. I don't really need to explore what that direction looks like or what's going to happen when they get there. Just the fact that they are on a different road, to me, is enough. And again, like, that's thinking about, like, character, right? And thinking about situations where these characters kind of keep running into each other. Mm-hmm. I wanted to create a narrative where these two characters who wouldn't really seem like they'd have a lot in common on the page or, you know, in person if they met each other, because of circumstances, were brought together in this specific moment and had to find their way out of this area, out of this neighborhood, out of this sort of loop. In a certain way, they were dependent upon each other. And I think any sort of arc that happens for them will be much more, any reader can do a much better job, I think, of imagining what that arc is going to look like than I could. And that's the part that I love, especially when, you know, the book is assigned to students, because they always want that sense, well, what happens next? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's the fun part. You get to decide that. Like, whatever outcome you think is appropriate for those characters, based upon your experience as a reader, that's the right outcome for you.
And in a way, you started to respond to one of my next questions, and that has to do with coincidence versus fate. Because I know throughout this book, I mean, people are seemingly randomly connecting.
Maybe some critics of the book felt I overdid it a little bit, right? But it's one of those things that the Japanese animator, Miyazaki, who has, you know, directed so many wonderful films, favorite films of mine, like Howl's Moving Castle and Spirited Away, was talking about animation. And it was one of those, like, behind-the-scenes clips, you know, where you get to hear the director talk about, you know, because I watch those kinds of things. And he said, in animation, and I would interpret this, I would extrapolate this to, expand this, I guess I should say, to include storytelling, you don't depict fate, you depict will.
Mm-hmm.
And that all good fiction comes from depicting the will of the characters. So I think that in setting up how these characters intersect, fate presents them a choice. And then their will takes it the rest of the way home. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, like, that's been, that's just been, like, that's just a crucial part of, like, my upbringing. It's a crucial part of, like, my life. I feel like, you know, when I was writing Madonna's, I was somewhat obsessed with that idea. You know, I had five stepfathers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, let's say, coincidence that is involved in a setup, right, where you had five stepfathers and a mom who would not only constantly change her own identity as the mood suited her, but then changed my own as the mood suited her,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think that sense of trying to reconcile those elements within inside a fictional narrative that made sense, you know, I was always conscious of the fact that I didn't want to overdo it. I didn't want it to see, like, oh, come on, right? Like, you know, this connection and then their paths crossed and blah, 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 blah. And like I said, maybe some people might have felt like I overdid it, but after I sent the pages off to the publishing house, this was, I think, in late, because it takes about 8 or 9 months. Once you've kind of finished everything, then, like, you go through the proofread and everything else, but basically everything was done with the book. I started work on the next book, which was my memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And from the time that I had sent Madonna's to the publishing house to the time it came out, I had rediscovered my biological father. I'd had his name, but I didn't have any other information about it. So in that block, I found out his address. We got back in touch. I found out that I had three half-sisters. I just call them my sisters now because that's how I do it.
Mm.
And I had this whole family that I had no idea existed. And when I went to meet them, I met my biological father's wife. And I found out that her name was, imagine of all names, Aurora.
Oh.
And I'm not making any of this up, right? So when the book came out, a couple of people were like, oh, Aurora, what a stereotypical name, right? But that was a name that, like, I had in my mind from a very, you know, sort of early conception of the book. And of all the names, right, they could, you know, like, what are the odds, right? Coincidence,
uh-huh.
right? Coincidence.
Yeah.
So I think that there was something that was speaking to me as I was putting the book together. I don't believe in, like, voices or things like that, but some sort of force outside the book was interested in toying with the idea or working with the idea of coincidence versus fate. And, you know, hopefully I came out on the right side of things.
And my final question for you is, and you alluded to this earlier, you know, we live in a time now, a country now, when instead of more, there seems to be less multicultural tolerance and more fear and anger than ever. So with this book, The Madonnas of Echo Park, did you or do you have a hope for what readers will take from it, what it can mean along these lines for a reader?
Every writer hopes that what they write is as good as they can make it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that every writer hopes that what they write won't be forgotten. And I think a part of that means that you're capturing a snapshot at a certain time and place. And I think the thing, and I'll just lay this out as an observation, and anyone who's listening to this and anyone who reads the book can make up their own minds. That's what I want people to make up their own minds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the themes in the book seem to be more relevant, right? They seem to be more applicable. I feel like the book is almost more timely now than it was back in 2010 when it was published. And I think that a part of that was like, oh, you know, demonize Mexican-Americans in 2010? We're past that. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Racism, done. Problem solved. Put it up on the shelf, right? And I think that where I was writing from, right, where I was calling from, where I was reporting from, was something that a lot of persons of color would tell you, well, this is the way it's always been for us. So you could say maybe it was a bit ahead of the curve, but you also could say that, oh, this is the alarm bell that certain members of our community have been like, you know, have been ringing for a while. And now it's only come up to the surface, right? Much in the same way, like, you know, oh, climate change, it's totally made up and blah, 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 right? This and that, right? You know, well, let's see where we are 30, 40 years. I mean, if we're going to wait that long, right? So I think that the book, in a certain way, feels timely because that has been the experience in this country for certain members of our community for years and years and years. And now I think we're at a place where those voices can be heard with greater clarity. And now you have books like Madonna's or many, many other wonderful books written by persons of color who are saying, hey, you know, we were telling you the time about 10 years ago. So, but hey, but, you know, better late than never, right?
Yeah. Brando Skyhorse, author of the novel The Madonnas of Echo Park, which is College of the Redwoods 2018-19 Book of the Year. The author will be reading from his work, answering questions, and will sign copies of his book at a special free public event to be held on Friday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Performing Arts Theater on CR's Eureka Main Campus. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Brando Skyhorse joined me by phone from his residence in Bloomington, Indiana. For more information about the CR Book of the Year program, you can visit redwoods.edu. I'm Wendy Butler, and this is Art Waves on KHSU. The 6th Annual Puppet Slam is this Saturday, November 3rd, at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. at Arcata's The Sanctuary. Each year, Arcata Playhouse has received funding from the Jim Henson Foundation for this community event. This year, it's being hosted by The Sanctuary. And one of the organizers, Sean Powers, told me this year it's almost exclusively going to be local puppeteers. Powers says puppetry, rather than being a dying art form, is growing in popularity.
I don't know why puppetry is big. It's always been around. I mean, it's been around since our childhood. And I just recently saw the Mr. Rogers movie that they made about him. And that really inspired me to think, wow, he really inspired me. And I'm sure he's inspired a lot of other people, good or bad. And so I think puppetry has gotten bigger because it's more accessible. And we want people to have access to this really simple, fun, compelling, interesting art form that really, I mean, children will not talk to an adult, but they'll talk to a puppet. And they'll tell them the puppet everything, and they won't tell the adult hardly anything.
And then also I'm thinking that so an adult can take on the persona of a puppet and say things in a certain way,
right,
or say certain things that you might not say,
right,
just coming out of your regular mouth.
Right. And you might not be so embarrassed or care as much. Because you might, sometimes you're, as a puppeteer, you're kind of hidden.
Yeah, kind of.
You're kind of behind a screen. There's puppeteers that are standing right next to the puppet, but they're talking to the puppet. Ventriloquism. It's like, what is going on? And it's like, it's a two-way conversation, but it's one person.
How many people do you have performing on the November 3rd event?
For the seven.
Seven different?
Yeah, and all the acts will be about 5 to 7 minutes long.
As far as the people performing, you said it's all local or mostly local?
It's all local except one group that's coming from Bellingham, Washington, and they're called West of Rowan. And they just happened to be coming through town, and they had asked the sanctuary if they could do a show there. And they said, oh, well, we're doing a puppet slam that weekend. And Daniel, one of the people that works at the sanctuary, told me that. And I said, oh, if they're going to be here, maybe they'd like to participate. And I saw a picture of just one puppet that they had, and I thought, oh, this is cool. So I called them up. I sent them a text or an email, and they responded. And I said, well, if you do a puppet slam, which is only a short amount of time, maybe we can get you another show. And so they're going to do a show at the Outer Space, which is another venue in Arcata. Arcata's full of venues right now that are kind of publicly ran, you know, community center places. And that organization is called Breakfast All Day Collective. And that's the Outer Space over across from the Portuguese Hall. And they're a really cool place too. So on the second, that group is going to perform there doing their whole show.
What is their topic?
I think it's two women, and I think they do songs, and they play cello and guitar, and they have shadow puppets. That's all I know about them.
Because I'm thinking about diversity as far as the puppet slam,
right.
Different performers.
Right.
So that's one, and that sounds really fascinating. So what about a couple of the others who are performing? What kind of subject matter or decoration?
Well, there's the Paranormal Society, which is Isaac Bluefoot. And he does his sock puppet things. He has kind of an ongoing series of shows that he does. And then there's Violet Crabtree is going to show some videos. She does claymation videos. She's going to show some couple videos. And then I'm going to do shadow puppet show. And then I met this guy through somebody else that made these really big and beautiful clay ceramic marionette puppets, which I'm trying to get him to come to do his thing. And Quack and Wabbit are going to do their thing, and they're well known around here. And a woman that named Camille that helped with the Avenue Q last year at HSU, she's a puppeteer. And Dave Fernie is going to do something. And then Bobby Burns is going to be the host, and I do Bobby Burns' puppet.
And Bobby Burns is a puppet.
Bobby Burns is a puppet. He's a world-famous puppet.
You're a puppet.
Yeah.
But not really your, because he probably, he doesn't want to think that you control him.
Oh, no.
No.
He's based on a real character that was in Sacramento that I used to watch from afar because I was just fascinated by the guy. He was an actual real person that was a drummer in the big band era. He used to wear the craziest clothes and slick back hair and no teeth. And he used to hang out with younger people, and he kind of talked like this. And hey, man, he had all this hip jive stuff he don't talk about. And he was a really good drummer. And when he died, somehow I inherited all his clothes. And so I took all his clothes, and out of the pile of clothes, I found a bow tie that was his. Because he was a character and he wore bow ties and funny clothes. And I put the bow tie on Bobby Burns before he was Bobby Burns, and I called him Bobby Burns. So that's how that puppet became Bobby Burns.
Sean Powers. The 6th annual Puppet Slam is Saturday, November 3rd at 2 p.m. for a special children and family show. And also a regular performance will be at 8 p.m. at the Sanctuary, 1301 J Street, Arcata. For more information, you can visit the Sanctuary on Facebook. That's all the time we have today. Art Waves is broadcast each Tuesday at 1:30 p.m., available anytime at khsu.org. And podcasts of this program are available for download from iTunes. Until next time, I'm Wendy Butler. Thank you for listening.